Welcome to the CompuSchmooze podcast. This is episode 22 for January 3rd, 2008. In this edition of the CompuSchmooze podcast, we have two interviews for you. First, Mrinal Desai is one of the developers of CrossLoop, a free, yes, free, program that lets you take control of another computer remotely over the internet. Desai's company is helping thousands of people in more than 140 countries solve PC problems by remote control. And they are even answering their customers' questions personally, even though most of those customers aren't paying anything.
It's extremely exciting to see our product being used by so many people, and we get all these stories about how people are helping their 90-year-old grandfather or, you know, people who were stuck with their computers, and just a small little miracle of life that allows people to just have a peace of mind. So it's really great to hear those stories.
Then we'll hear about the video blog site aliveinbaghdad.org, where professional Iraqi TV journalists are risking everything to produce video news reports for the web on what daily life is like for ordinary Iraqis. These are stories you won't see on the mainstream media.
So we're really hoping that people are going to step forward and going to say, okay, we do really want to have news and journalism that has integrity and values, access and, you know, personal connection and those sorts of things over tabloidism, 24/7 coverage, flash and graphics. You know, we try to produce a professional product with integrity, but, you know, people are going to have to step forward and say that they want to support that.
I'm your host, Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for joining us. Hi everyone, Steve Lubetkin here. As you probably know, I write the CompuSchmooze technology column that appears every month in the Jewish Community Voice of Southern New Jersey. It's on the web at jewishcommunityvoice.org. This podcast supplements my column and provides me an opportunity to give you a little bit more depth about the interviews and the topics that we write about in the column. If you have comments or suggestions about the podcast, please email me. The address is steve@compuschmooze.com. That's spelled CompuSchmooze.com. You can also call our podcast comment line and leave us an audio comment. The U.S. number is +1-856-861-6146. If you're in Europe, you can dial +44-0207-193-6146. CrossLoop is a program you can download for free. It lets you connect to another computer running CrossLoop so that you can help someone in a distant city troubleshoot some problem by taking remote control of their computer. It worked out particularly well for me because my mom lives about an hour away, and she often needs help with her computer that it's hard to provide by talking her through it, like many tech support people do at help desks for organizations and corporations. So normally what happens is I have to get in the car and drive up there, and it's usually a problem that can be fixed in a relatively short amount of time. So in one particular situation, having read about CrossLoop and having walked Mom through installing it on her computer, we discovered that the format I had prepared for her to print out mailing labels for her holiday cards was designed for labels that come in sheets of two columns of labels, and she had inadvertently gone out and bought a three-column package of labels. So I needed to reformat that design that I had created, and I was able to do that by connecting to her computer over CrossLoop, and it took me about 10 or 15 minutes to do the work, and of course I saved the two-hour round-trip drive going up there to fix it for her. Now, what's most surprising about CrossLoop is not that it's free. What's surprising and what's interesting is the personal attention that the developers of the program want to give people, even though they're not yet paying for the privilege of using the program. At the end of each connection session, CrossLoop asks you for feedback. And if you send the feedback about the experience, you get a personal email from one of the founders of the company thanking you for the feedback and inviting you to stay in touch with them and give them more feedback. We thought this was interesting, so we got in touch with Mrinal Desai, who's one of the founders of the company, and we talked with Mrinal about the program's origins.
Welcome to the podcast, Mrinal, and tell us a little bit about how you founded the company, what made you think of cross-loop functionality as something that you thought was lacking in the marketplace in some way.
Yeah, the genesis partly was just from the fact that one of our chief architects, he had a personal problem. He was the one who had the personal problem, which actually sparked the whole initial story. And his father had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And he needed to have a way to be able to take care of his father remotely. And one of the best ways to do that was to get across to his computer. And his father was in Seattle. Our CTO, the other co-founder, is here in California. And, you know, they had also a geographically distributed family, brothers in Connecticut and the East Coast and stuff. So they just wanted an easy way to be able to remotely help their dad out. And one of the ways to do it was to be able to remotely access the computer of the father, so they could either turn on, say, Skype if they wanted to talk, or they could just reach across the computer and turn on the video camera, or, you know, just share pictures from their computer. So that's kind of where it really started, and hence the product is so easy to use too, is because it was, you know, its genesis was with a person who was not technically quote-unquote savvy.
Now, you are giving away the program, the basic cross-loop program, as a free download, and I've already downloaded it and walked my mom mm-hmm. through installing it on her computer, and mm-hmm. it worked very well, and she was able to do that, and we're now able to connect. What's the business model going to be, though? You obviously can't make revenue from, you know, giving away the program forever. There has to be some revenue opportunity for you.
Right, absolutely. And that's a good question. I mean, the way we look at it is, you know, one is, in this environment, advertising can never be written off, but we don't advertise today at all. But we see more of an opportunity in adding premium services to it. So it could be, you know, users saying, hey, I want, you know, maybe a custom version. Or, hey, can you give me this particular feature that will sit on my computer, on my company servers? So then, you know, those are the things that we are right now listening to. Based on demand, we roll those things out if it's appropriate to our business strategy. But getting it out there free initially, the most powerful thing is that it allows us to listen and build something that people want to buy rather than us saying, hey, we build this, now go sell it. You know, so there's just a different philosophy in terms of actually listening and building something that really fulfills people's needs rather than us, a few of us sitting here and saying, oh, this is what everyone would need, and we should just push that hard.
Now, you've obviously gotten some positive press recently. The program was mentioned in the Wall Street Journal, and I think that led to a big uptick in your downloads. I know it certainly drew my attention. What were some of the technical challenges you had in creating the program, if there were any?
The biggest challenge, I think, that we've done really well is the ability to break through firewalls. And it's all built on a peer-to-peer technology, so which means we don't have to have high-end back-end servers to host these sessions. So once you and your mom, say, are having a session, the only place where we were involved in that session would be to confirm that the access code that both of you shared was between the two right people who wanted to connect, and then we completely back out of it, and then you're basically peer-to-peer directly. So our servers are not involved in it, and hence it saves us money. It's a lower capital business. So I think the peer-to-peer part and, you know, going through firewalls.
What's the future strategy for the program? Just listening to the customers who are using it now and then going forward and building in additional premium functionality?
Yeah, and you know, we want to continuously fine-tune the program itself. That's one thing that we're always working on. And then slowly start getting more and more distribution that hopefully, you know, now we're seeing more and more people talk about us. And we're now being used in over 140 countries. And so now build out features that basically allow people to do what they want to do to really add value to their problems that they're facing. So just start rolling those features out.
Anything I didn't ask you about, Mrinal, that you'd like to bring across to the audience?
the philosophy that we have as a group is that, you know, yes, there are tons and tons of companies out there, but as a core philosophy of this company and as a culture, we really like to build relationships with our users. So unlike today, you know, if you would typically interact with a company, you'd probably just get an email which comes from a noreply@company.com, and you would probably never know anyone in that company. You know, whether it's a long phone call when you're calling in for tech support and you have to be on hold, or you know, you're just in this whole daisy chain in their phone system, we have taken the opposite tack and saying, look, even though it's a free product, we want to give you the best possible service, and you will always have someone available whom you know personally. So we are people doing business with people, not a company doing business with people. And that has really, really you know, helped us to understand our users. Our users have been extremely supportive too. I mean, that's another thing is which is very inspiring is the number of stories that come in on a daily basis, and how much they're encouraging everyone else to create more awareness for us. So we really love our users.
How many folks do you have working at the company right now?
Now we have 8.
And plans to grow, or you like it at this size, or where are you going to take it?
I think we will need to grow. Just the growth that we have right now, we will need to continuously keep adding people. But, you know, hopefully because it's a low capital business, we won't have to add too many people also. It'll be, you know, just a nice little group.
Anything on your wish list in terms of functionality that that you particularly would like to see added down the road?
I think, you know, things like, you know, chatting, I think my personal thing would be, it'd be a great thing to have, is being able to chat sometimes. My family is back home in India, and sometimes it's kind of hard to get hold of them. So I personally like, you know, the chat functionality that can be added where people can be made available. I think that'll be good. And the other one, I think, I'm a Windows user, but I think having a product that's across platforms would be another powerful thing to have. So today, CrossLoop is only on Windows. We certainly, you know, are looking at that very seriously and working towards it so that then if a user is on a Mac, on a Linux box, or on a Windows box, they can still use it.
Anything that I didn't ask you that you want to mention?
Well, I want to first thank you for this opportunity. You know, the more people get to hear about us, the more exciting it gets for us. And, you know, it's funny being a small company and having, you know, the product is being used in over, you know, 140 countries, as I said, it's extremely exciting to see our product being used by so many people. And we get all these stories about how people are helping their 90-year-old grandfather or, you know, people who are stuck with their computers. And just a small little miracle of life that allows people to just have a peace of mind. So it's really great to hear those stories.
And it's, you know, as I mentioned in my email to the company, you know, it was really funny to watch the video and have your other colleague describing exactly the situation that I was in terms of trying to provide support for my mom over a long distance. So it truly does work, and we appreciate it, and we thank you for being with us on the podcast today.
It's my pleasure, Steve.
Before we go to our next interview, we want to continue with the feature we started in the last CompuSchmooze podcast, and that's a musical spotlight on new and emerging artists available on the web. The track is from Lev Yatan. It's called To Be, and it comes from the new Mystic Heart collection. And it comes to the podcast courtesy of the IOTA PromoNet service. You look for That's Lev Yatan with the track To Be from the Mystic Heart CD, just released in December. AliveInBaghdad.org is a video blog that features professionally produced TV documentaries about real life for ordinary Iraqis. It's the brainchild of Brian Connolly of Philadelphia. Brian's a videographer who spent 2 years filming documentary material in Iraq. Brian recruited professional Iraqi video crews to produce the reports. They've included features on Iraq's Royal Cemetery, a Baghdad printing plant that employed more than 900 people, both men and women, and yet was being shut down by the Iraqi government without any clear explanation, throwing all of those people out of work. Other reports featured Iraqi refugees working in Syria and athletes disabled in car bombings and other terror attacks training for the Paralympics. Now, Alive in Baghdad supports its productions with donations for viewers, a lot like public television, and also by selling or licensing video footage to the mainstream news media. It's particularly ironic that the mainstream news media depend on Alive in Baghdad to obtain video footage that they consider too dangerous to shoot themselves. It's ironic because Alive in Baghdad's team is facing those dangers on its own. It became painfully clear last month when correspondent Ali Shafia al-Musawi, a 23-year-old reporter, was killed in a raid by Iraqi security forces just 1 day short of his 24th birthday. Ali's two brothers were killed in a suicide bombing in 2005, so that left just his mother and sister as survivors. His father was also killed earlier. The response to Ali's murder from users of the social networking media on the internet has been pretty amazing. Within hours of Brian posting the news of Ali's death on Twitter.com, participants in that instant messaging service organized a donation process for the Alive in Baghdad website. They created a chip-in button where people could click and use PayPal, the online payment service, to donate money for the funeral expenses. Within a matter of hours, more than $2,000 was contributed for Ali's funeral expenses. The Alive in Baghdad blog, which is part of the website, includes a letter of appreciation received from Ali's family for the kindness shown by people that they don't even know who responded in cyberspace. As of the production of this podcast, the Committee to Protect Journalists, an international group which keeps track of journalists killed in the line of their occupation, has not yet listed Ali on its website as having been killed while practicing his journalistic craft. We hope that that happens eventually, but it has not happened as of this time. We spoke with Brian about Alive in Baghdad and about Ali's murder just a few days after he learned of the death. Brian, welcome to the CompuSchmooze podcast.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Brian, first of all, from us and from all of our listeners, condolences on the tragic death of your correspondent, Ali, in Baghdad. At this point, is there anything new to report about his killing? Anything that you've learned over the last several days?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much the only thing really new that we can say is, you know, it's turned up that he received a death threat about a week before he was killed. That death threat is not, you know, clearly specifically related to Alive in Baghdad. So, it's hard to say whether that's even actually connected to the killing. We kind of, one would assume that it is, given the recency, but it's unclear. You know, Ali, for whatever reason, had chosen not to inform us about the threat, and we found out about it from his cousin who found him after he'd been killed. As far as I understand it, you know, it was torn up, so we don't even have a copy, you know, with which to review or gather other information.
Now, when you learned about his killing, the word went out on some of the social media that you and I both take part in, the Twitter network and some of the other blogs that people are connecting to Alive in Baghdad through. And a significant amount of money was raised to help his family defray the funeral expenses. What was your reaction to how quickly that sort of effort mobilized in the social media?
You know, within like the first day or day and a half, you know, it was some, but it was not. It was certainly nothing compared to what came later. You know, it came on, I guess, he was killed on Friday, which is when I started sort of raising money, but it wasn't really until, I guess, Saturday evening or Sunday that we really started to raise, you know, a large amount. So I think it took a little time to gain critical mass, but certainly I was very surprised at how much we raised, you know, in such a short time. I mean, it was, I guess, you know, $2,100 or so through the Chip-In widget and then some hundreds beyond that from other donations.
Let's talk a little bit about Alive in Baghdad. Alive in Baghdad is a project of your video company, Small World News. How did you get the idea, first of all, to start Small World News, and then how did you get the idea for Alive in Baghdad, and then its successor project, which I guess begins soon, Alive in Mexico?
In fact, Alive in Baghdad predates the rest of it. Alive in Baghdad was originally founded as sort of a documentary project for the web, you know, where I would go to Iraq and interview as many people as possible and just post their interviews sort of in as direct a manner as possible for just people, you know, in the public to view and to hear a little bit about, you know, what people in Iraq wanted to say to the international community, particularly given that there was little, if any, coverage or interaction with the street level, you know, sort of civilian daily life, you know, everyday Iraqis. You know, there's very little in general, specifically in video and television, there's almost none. In traditional documentaries, sure, there have been a lot of great filmmakers who've gone to Iraq, but they're taking 2 years, 3 years even, to get their content out, generally. So I was hoping to sort of to change that. Now, I guess about a year into Alive in Baghdad's existence, we kind of realized that it was a little difficult to raise money just for Alive in Baghdad. And so we thought, well, you know, we need to have some sort of organization but to make things a little more formal, and we'd like to start some other projects that are similar that maybe could raise money. So, in fact, you know, we started Alive in Mexico late in 2006, but it's still taking a lot of time to gain traction and really get it going. We had sort of just started getting Alive in Mexico pretty regular when we ran out of funds, and that's, you know, been a pretty big setback for us there.
So now you are working to generate funds from supporters, a lot like the public television model. Talk about how that's going. Talk about the opportunities that you see for people to support the projects that you're working on.
Yeah, well, you know, we've always made it possible for people to donate, but that's always been kind of difficult to get regularity on. And then we recently started something where we were allowing people to voluntarily choose to make a paying, to pay for content that they could get for free. And that's actually been well received, and we're making, you know, we probably have maybe 36 or maybe more. I'm not quite sure what the current count is. You know, giving us money every month and ranging from, you know, $5 to $25. And that's the thing we really encourage people to do most is, you know, consider if you value the work, if you are interested to find the content, you know, consider spending a little bit of money, you know, to support Iraqi journalists. And for the last couple of months, we've actually brought in about, I'd say, around $1,000 a month, which is no small amount, but given the sort of the cost that we're looking at, you know, it certainly is not enough to support one American staff per month. And, you know, it's maybe a third of our costs for the Iraq side, you know, for the Iraqi correspondents, the coordinator, translation, all of those things. So we're really hoping that people are going to step forward and are going to say, okay, we do really want to have news and journalism that has integrity and values, access and, you know, personal connection and those sorts of things over tabloidism, 24-hour, you know, 7 coverage, flash and graphics, you know. We try to produce a professional product with integrity, but, you know, people are going to have to step forward and say that they want to support that. We have other ways that we're doing, you know, we also formed Small World News as a production company so that we could do short documentaries and things like that for other news agencies that wanted to do coverage in Iraq but didn't have the access that we had. And that's been the primary way that we funded ourselves in the past. Right now, we're still trying to work on closing some more of those deals. And so currently the primary funding is from the viewership, it's from the audience.
Going back to the Iraq experience, you were actually there for a period of time yourself producing videos. What was it like for you as an American videographer to be in Baghdad talking to ordinary Iraqis, and how does that contrast with how your Iraqi crews are working today?
Well, that was in, I guess that was in 2005, and you know, I went pretty much everywhere, which is different from the current team. You know, the current team, each guy sort of focuses in a certain number of neighborhoods based on security and safety and comfort level. However, they're certainly able to get much more in-depth material, and they're getting a lot more visuals of what his daily life actually looked like. Whereas when I was there, I was strictly able to do almost entirely interviews, and it was hard to do anything other than that, you know, to really get B-roll and the other kind of content that you want to be able to support the material.
And they are producing stories about daily life for ordinary Iraqis. What is the mechanics of the process? How do they actually get the programs? Do they send finished product to you, or do they send you raw material that you do post-production on in Philadelphia?
Yeah, no, we do all the post-production at our office in South Philly. And that's, you know, as much at our request as it is at their request. I mean, you know, we've actually been trying to figure out how we can put more of the control over there and more of the post-production over there, as much for cost and content as for, you know, flexibility and our ability to focus a little more on starting new projects in other areas of the world, or, you know, also continuing the Mexico project. So they essentially right now, they go and they, you know, I speak with Omar, who's our bureau chief, pretty much, you know, every day. And then he and I discuss stories, and then we also discuss stories with the correspondents, and we all kind of throw the ideas back and forth until we come up with what are the things we're going to do for this month. And, you know, we generally have a pool of stories that are we've been wanting to do for a while, that we just pull a few of those in every month, and then we try to do stories that are also a little more timely every month. So we talk, we discuss, we come up with the story ideas. The guys will go out and they'll shoot the work, and then by the end of the month, they'll send us all their tapes, and they'll come to the office. We'll upload them. We'll collect the material and make it available to our translator for download. She'll download it, translate, transcribe all the material, send us a time code. You know, then it's made basically what's called a paper edit, which is just sort of an initial sort of storyline from the transcript. They'll put it together, and you know, we do all the post production here. We thought, you know, if we can, we try to get Omar, the bureau chief, to check out the stories beforehand, see if he has any suggestions. And certainly, you know, I'll look over them after Steve, our editor, puts it together to make sure everything sort of makes sense and has clarity. And it just goes like this, you know. I mean, the guys are producing the stories, they're doing all the production work, and we're doing all the post-production, distribution, and most of the fundraising over here.
One of the things that you've also done to try to supplement the income is the licensing of video footage to the mainstream media. Has that been successful? Is there demand for the footage that your folks are shooting over there?
There is demand, and it's been moderately successful. I mean, it was very successful initially, and then now we're having a little difficulty getting some new deals. I mean, but I think the largest difficulty is not the lack of desire for our material. It's simply the bureaucracy of sort of very large organizations. You know, it takes a while for them to both to contact somebody who's the right person to talk to, and then once we've contacted that person, or they've even contacted us, you know, then the discussion of the cost comes in, and then they have to go and locate the money and make sure, yes, we can verify this cost. And they have to specify what it is they want. We have to say, yes, we can do that. And, you know, all this takes an awful long time. And that's, you know, that's brought us to right now, where here again, the same companies that we spoke with at the end of last year and beginning of this year about doing content for March 2007 are talking about, you know, trying to get us to do some content for them for March 2008, you know, again, for the anniversary of the invasion. And we're still sort of trying to get out of this mode where we're able to sell a lot of content once a year and a little bit of content the rest of the year, and we're really trying to figure out a way to have regularity of our production and licensing deals.
Are there any other points of interest that you would want to mention that you think people would want to know about?
We don't see this as an Iraq-only project or a Middle East-only project. We're really hoping to expand and, you know, build more bureaus elsewhere. And it's just a question of figuring out how to fund it and finding the, you know, interest for the content. And that's still, you know, still unclear.
Where do you see this going, this sort of citizen journalism, as you expand into other countries, other markets? Do you see this as a viable model for the future, with despite all the frustrations you're facing now? Where do you think it's going?
Well, I think, you know, I think that while it may not replace the news, you know, I wouldn't be so arrogant as to say that this is like the entire future of news. I do think that it's a very large part of the future, and I think that, you know, as this content becomes more available and more viable, people, you know, organizations like CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, CBS, all these larger companies are not going to be able to say, well, we're doing the best we can do. You know, they're not going to be able to say, sorry, you know, we want to do that, you know, we want to do more in-depth stories, but it's just not possible. Because people are going to be able to go to aliveinbaghdad.org and say, well, here it is, it is possible, you know, at a very small fraction of the costs that are spent by the larger news organizations. Now, that doesn't mean we should be doing our work for nothing, you know, and it's certainly there's a sustainability question, and that remains to be seen, is how do we, you know, match sustainability with doing something that no one else has done before and really producing kind of content that people are not really clear on yet. We're not really clear on where it's going or how it's going to be successful. You know, I think that it will be possible in the future, but we're still moving towards that sustainability question. But on the other hand, you know, if all of our subscribers, you know, not talking about all of our viewers, just all of our subscribers, all the people who get the content every week, you know, gave us $5 a month, which is our minimum subscription request, we'd have, you know, two or three times the amount of money we need every month to run our operation.
Talk a little bit about who's on your staff to the extent that you can. Talk about who some of the Iraqis are. Talk about who else is working with you on this.
We've got a staff of, right now we have four correspondents, two part-time and two full-time. It's primarily a financial issue more than anything. We have, you know, Kurdish guys, we have Sunni guys, we have Shia guys. Everybody who works with us right now as a correspondent has had experience as a professional journalist, you know, working for a television company, either as a cameraman or a correspondent or both. And that's really what we've been trying to figure out a way to do, is just to find people who do have the training and the experience, who are hoping to be able to do something better and something different, you know, something they couldn't do with their local media or even with, you know, the problems that the American companies, you know, especially TV companies, are not able to give people the kind of access yet that they want, you know, to really doing the production and doing the full thing from concept to completion. And so, you know, we've been hiring guys who are journalists, essentially, people who are doing work on all angles. You know, one of our guys has been doing producing television for 10 years. Yeah, you know? So it's certainly, it's not just a citizen journalism project. But
that's a good point to make. These are professional journalists with a lot of experience who are working with you.
Right, exactly.
Where do you see it playing out? Where do you see Alive in Baghdad, Alive in Mexico, any of the other plans heading in the future?
Well, I think there is going to be, you know, it could be that we end up operating kind of as a wire service, similar to AP or Reuters. I don't know yet if that's going to be what happens. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the best financial option. But I do think that subscriptions and advertising are both going to blow up as the, you know, internet continues to expand and people can have more and more access to the content. These things are all going to become easier. You know, and it's just a matter of keeping our heads above water. And I think because we're here at the beginning, we're going to have a different kind of access than other companies that are trying to make a name for themselves starting now.
Well, we wish you great good luck with it. And again, our condolences to you and your team and to Ali's family on the tragic loss of someone who was doing a very brave thing in trying to keep journalism alive in Iraq in a very dangerous situation.
Sure. Thank you so much, and I hope all your viewers will look forward to his work, which we hope it'll be able, ready for air in January, early February.
And that'll be the last report that he prepared?
Yeah, he was working on a series of three investigative reports, two of which were completed before his death, as far as we know. We're waiting to see the material. We'll be putting together a special once we have that.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to that and alert people to it when it comes out.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, take good care.
All right, thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
And that concludes our program for this time. If you'd like information on our two subjects in this podcast, you can find them at these links, which we'll also post in the show notes. For CrossLoop, you can download the program and learn more about the company at crossloop.com. For Alive in Baghdad, you can visit aliveinbaghdad.org. And please be sure to visit the main page of the site and make a contribution to the support of Alive in Baghdad, and also to the funeral expenses for Ali, their correspondent. If you have comments or suggestions about our podcast, please email me at steve@compuschmooze.com. We'd also be pleased to receive audio comments. Again, the comment line number in the U.S. is +1-856-861-6146. In Europe, it's +44-0207-193-6146. For more information on our podcasting and video podcasting services, you can visit our website, professionalpodcasts.com. And we do produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts, LLC, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. This is Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening, and have a real happy new year. We'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.